Welcome to the Portion Podcast, a weekly discussion of the Torah portion of the week. I'm your host, Aaron Roller, here with our other host, Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld.
Also known as a co-host.
So, what's going on?
Threw you for a loop there, didn't I?
Yes.
All's great. It's snowing outside, but we are nice and rather warm inside, and the warmth of the fire of Torah will keep us going.
Yes, the weather outside is frightful, but the Torah is so delightful.
Well said.
That's on my tryout track for to be a voiceover artist.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. Okay. So this week we are a week away from our live recording. There's going to be one episode between now and then, but that episode's only coming out like 2 or 3 days before the show. So we're about a week away from our recording. It's going to be the end of Sefer Shemot, the Book of Exodus, Parshat Pekudei. It'll be fun.
It's going to be great.
It'll be great.
Really great. Great Parsha, great people, great times.
Absolutely. So go to the CATS JCC website. That's the JCC of Southern New Jersey and in Cherry Hill, and book your tickets to the forum. There'll be other sessions, other things to see, people to hear, but definitely you'll get to come to the live recording, which we're very excited about. The Torah portion this week is Parshat Ki Tisa. This is, in some ways, I've been looking forward to this week's recording for a long while.
Is it because you like idolatry?
No comment. I like it in the story. Well, you know, it's a little bit of a break. I think the last couple weeks have been really interesting, but it's been a little. I think the podcasts have been interesting, but reading the text of the Torah, it has not been narrative. It's been
technical. Very technical.
It's been technical, and this we get a combination of things here, but it's definitely some return to narrative. Looking big picture, let's look at the Parsha. So the sort of set of instructions that Moshe has been getting winds down with a couple of really interesting interesting instructions, and then we kind of step back, you know, the camera kind of pulls back and you're like, oh right, all of this has been within the context of a dialogue essentially, or of God teaching Moshe what to do on top of Mount Sinai, and now we're kind of back into narrative storytelling mode, and we get the sin of the golden calf, which if we talked about the revelation and the giving of the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai as being probably the climax of the Torah, so we have the sin of the spies that's going to come later, so I think that's probably the official, not official, but like that's a real low point, but it's so bad.
You could say it's just so bad what happens here.
It's almost shocking, and we're going to talk to it. So we get the sin of the golden calf, and we get the aftermath, and that's going to be our point of departure for talking about this week's Parsha. It's so bad, staggering, and really staggering. So, but first, let's talk about these commands that are given. We've got the machatzit ha-shekel, the half of a shekel. It's a coin. It's actually the Israeli currency today. And I love, you know, I know we talked about it when we talked about the, what's the word, mascot emblem, the logo for the Israeli Postal Service, that I love to see the echoes of the Torah in modern day Israel, where the logo is a gazelle or a deer, because the tribe of Naphtali were spreading messages, and they were compared to a gazelle. So similarly here, the Israeli currency is the shekel today, and that's kind of a cool thing. And we're going to get another cool resonance to modern day Israel shortly. But anyway, this command that when you're doing a census, God says, when you're doing a count of the population. It's really a military census. It's really to know how to marshal your military forces. The way to count everybody is by collecting half a shekel. And it's weird for two reasons. Number one, that's a weird way to count anything, I think. Just, you know, oh, give 50 cents. And we're going to count how many 50 cents we have. And
half
that's
dollars.
How many half dollars?
There you go.
Anyone, do they still make half dollars?
I don't know. They're hard to get. I know because when we have the custom of doing Machatzita Shekel in Shul before Purim, in years past, now I'm very, very careful about where I keep them year to year. But in years past, it's not as simple as just walking into a bank and saying, hey, here's $1.25. Can I have, can we turn that into half dollars, please? It's not so simple.
There's been a bank run on half dollars.
Yeah. Not so simple.
So that's strange in its own right. And then I would take it one step further and say, the Torah says pretty explicitly that the reason you do this count like this is to avoid plague of some sort. And this plays into a pretty well-accepted custom not to count Jews. That there's this idea of, the poo-poo-poo, if we say there's, X number of people around, and I think it plays out, you'd have to go to different communities and hear it out. But I know for myself, when someone says, how many children do you have? It's always like, Kaninahara, and you don't want to acknowledge the numbers because the numbers are not always a stable thing. But that said, but it goes further because so it's like ingrained in the DNA of the Jewish people because it says here that doing this is going to prevent the kind of negative feelings and without getting into what Ayin Hara is, but this evil eye. Like, but I think the question, so like doing it this way is going to prevent that. But the question comes up, why? Like, why is who are you fooling? If it helps you get a precise count, then you counted. So why does that? Like, if counting is the thing that's going to be bad, like how does this get around that?
So I think it's a couple of things, and I don't know that it's really simple to have the conversation without at least touching on what the whole idea of Ayin Hara really is, but effectively it could be looked at.
You ready to get into it?
Let's roll. Well, like anything, or like many things, even things that are mystical and metaphysical. There's another. There are always a couple different wavelengths upon which we could view any dimension of Judaism or Torah or halacha, law, mitzvot. And on the one hand, Ayin Hara is this scary. Ayin Hara literally means the evil eye. And somehow or another, there are these very negative forces at work. And when we isolate people and when we acknowledge individual people, that's when these forces come into play. These very negative kinds of forces come into play. And on a more maybe grounded or rationalistic, I suppose, level, and not to say that either one necessarily obscures the other, or that it's that they're mutually exclusive in any way, but that we understand that when something stands out, that we tend to look at and scrutinize that item, to a greater degree. And I think here, the idea of specifically, and this is a probably the standard, the golden standard in explaining why specifically, the half dollar piece, why the half shekel piece, is because it's a reminder that no Jew stands alone, and that we combine to form this greater kahila, congregation, nation, and that no individual is looked upon exclusively as an individual. When you look at individuals, and when you look at the numbers, sort of in that way, it obscures the reality, which is that the Jewish people are never going to operate according to strict numbers. It's never going to be that as the smallest nation, so we'll have the smallest impact, or that as being few in numbers, we'll never really be able to accomplish all that much. There's this force field that we often tend to walk around with, and there's this divine quality and this divine assistance in everything that we do. And the idea of trying to look upon any given individual as being isolated from the rest of the camp just isn't appropriate.
The main way that we see this play out on a daily basis, I would say, is in counting 10 men for a minyan.
Right.
Where you're not supposed to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You use some kind of substitute. Most people most people say, what's it called?
Hoshea
Temecha Uvarach Et Nachatecha Orem V'Nasam Ad Olam, a ten word phrase which actually refers to God save the nation. I had a chavrusa study partner once who gave me an alternative though, from the disco era, that you could say, that's the way, I like it, and that's your.
It's so odd that never caught on.
Yet, right.
It hasn't yet caught on. Maybe now that we're speaking about it here,
we're definitely starting the trend right now. Disco lives. All right, can we talk a little bit about chronology here? Because, like I said, it kind of like we kind of pull back and say, oh, all of these, you know, the format that the Parshiot have been taking for the last couple of weeks is that God has been speaking to Moshe on Mount Sinai, right? He's been saying, okay, this is what the tabernacle looks like, and this is how you make the menorah, and this is how you make the different altars, and this is the fabrics you're using, and all that stuff, and this, you know, and this is how you conduct a census also. And just to close it down, to tie a bow around that topic, the reason that is in context of the tabernacle, the half shekel census, is because those funds are used to help run the tabernacle every year.
Yeah, there are three different. I mean, we actually take note of the presence of the word truma, which means I guess a donation or a fundraising, three different times, and it's for three different purposes. But effectively, at least the one that takes place not as a one-shot deal, but really as an annual donation, is there not so much for the Beit HaMikdash itself or for the Mishkan itself, but actually being able to have this fund from which we pay for the communal sacrifices that needs to be replenished every year, and therefore it's done every year.
All right, so that's what that's doing there. But the point is that kind of we sort of step back and go, oh, right, this was actually, it wasn't just a set of instructions. It was actually God speaking to Moshe. We're kind of back in the story, and Moshe's up on the, he's up on Mount Sinai. I guess one more thing I want to talk about is the introduction of the craftsman, the master artist who's leading the building effort gotta get the order straight here. Is Bezalel. Bezalel,
great name.
Yes, great indeed. Name. Someone should name a kid that.
Yeah.
Bezalel is the, he is Ben Uri Ben Chor. He's from the tribe of Judah, and he has his main supporter, Aholiab, who is from the tribe of, is it Dan?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, so one of the most populous tribes, and then the one of the smallest, sort of least prominent, and they are leading the effort, sort of showing that the whole nation's involved, which has been a theme throughout. Firstly, that's the resonance that I was talking about, that Israel's art school is called Bezalel.
Oh, very cool.
So, yeah, you know, right. that's the resonance right there.
Yeah, we love those things.
How do they know what to do? Like, the idea that they were a nation of slaves doesn't necessarily suggest skilled artisans, necessarily.
Meaning, where did they actually hone their craft?
Yeah.
Right. I don't know. I mean,
or more generally, how does he come to the fore as a personality? We don't know a lot about Bezalel. We know, you know, his family is, but like, biographically speaking, unless the Medrash is filling something in, I'm not really fully, you know, I don't know a lot about him.
I mean, why would you assume that it's any different from, you know, when there were skilled Jewish laborers who the Nazis, you know, employed for their specific uses? They were jewelers, and mm-hmm. they were technicians, and mm-hmm. they were engineers, and they were artists and the like.
Yeah, no, like Primo Levi. Writer wrote, he was a chemist, and he worked in a laboratory during the Holocaust. That's true.
Meaning that if it's a skill that emerges, I would imagine that, you know, not every Jew was simply pushing bricks around, but that if there were specific talents that emerged, that those were, maybe, or maybe so, but those talents maybe emerged before. Couldn't have emerged before because obviously the slavery lasted longer.
That's what I was going to say.
That's what you're driving at. Meaning there was no opportunity for freedom to sort of allow those.
I guess we just don't know. But the point is that there's, and they're leading an effort. They're leading, and I love the idea. I love the idea that he is like across the board. Like he can do the weaving, and he does the metal work, and he does carpentry. Like this guy is
also very Israeli. Also very Israeli, right? That's really the claim that's made in Startup Nation, that the reason why Israelis in particular seem to always be in these positions to create these startups and to sort of bring other disciplines into high tech is really because it's sort of the nature of the army, that in the army the best and brightest will perforce need to be sort of jacks of all trades. They will be those who have the ability to sort of unite different disciplines and sort of see the crossroads between them. So, you know, put Batalo there, put him there also.
Startup, not just the art school, but the startup tech sector.
That's right.
I like it. So anyway, we get Batalo. We get the idea that it's not just generic work happening. Obviously, it's a full sort of sets the precedent, which. You know, there's been pushback on in recent years of, you know, you give credit to the architect, but you don't give credit to the bricklayer who actually built, you know, they say that architect built the building when in fact, you know, he may have never actually laid a brick to build the building. But although we do get the sense that Batal is in fact a craftsman himself, he's not just a skilled designer. So this is the work, he's marshaling the work of many, many people. But he's the sort of the name, he and Aholiav, which is a name which neither name really rolls off the tongue, but you don't see a lot of Aholiavs.
No, not
out
too
there.
Many.
There are some Batalels in the world.
Right. We've taken the word holy from Aholiav.
That's not true.
I think that's accurate. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
You're joking.
Of course I'm joking.
Okay. Just
What kind of ridiculous kind of etymological connection could that be? Anyway.
But hole. We got the word hole from his name.
Yeah, that's right. That's correct.
He made all these loops and circles, I think rings.
That I do think is just about as accurate as what I'd said.
That's more Edmel. It's about as etymologically sound.
I think you're raising an interesting point, and maybe that's exactly the reason why. You know, it is unusual that we have this parsha that really is introducing us to two standouts, and maybe that's why the backdrop at the beginning of the parsha really needs to be this idea of the machatzit hashekel, specifically. It's this half shekel, because there needs to be this realization, both for those who will serve as the standouts, who are going to get that degree of credit as being skilled artisans, as being skilled craftsmen, that will be able to do a job that nobody else can, need to realize that you're part of a greater whole, you're part of a greater process. Even you, with all of your insight and ingenuity, you can't really get the thing done on your own. And then it's for everybody else that doesn't really get named and doesn't really get mentioned. Remember, it's your half connects to his half, and your halves connect to the halves as sort of the, I don't know if I'll call them elitists, but those who are recognized for very, very specific and particular skill, and by sort of devoting yourself and by connecting to the rest of the nation as a whole, so you are as much a part of the process as they are.
It's that I like that a lot. I like the idea that we get the two names. It's not just one master builder, but there's a, you know, the mass, there's essentially two, and that, yeah, I never thought of that before, that very much ties into the idea of interdependence that is brought about by the census through the half shekel. And I'm not making any political judgment, but this was a real issue in the campaign of 2012, if people remember back that far, when you know, people really took President Obama to task for saying, regarding you know, business leaders, you didn't build that. Right when he said anybody who you know, had a truck that was going on the interstate, or anybody who you know, applied for a business loan or a grant or something like that, that nobody does it alone, essentially. And you have to see that we're all interdependent. And then, you know, Romney and all the, you know, and basically all the, and then the Republican side was like that he's you know, degrading the hard work of entrepreneurs, and obviously the truth is more complicated. It's somewhere in the middle.
Right.
It's, you know, that you count, but you also have to recognize that you only count for a half shekel.
The book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell is almost entirely dedicated to that idea. The concept that as much as we sort of revel in the idea of the self-made man, and the idea that somebody who is really brilliant and talented and hardworking and entrepreneurial will always be able to rise to the top. He takes a number of very, very famous examples, probably the most famous of which is Bill Gates, and speaks about how just unbelievably lucky he was to have lived in a particular time in a particular part of the country where there were specific things going on. He had a specific pedigree, and he had specific parents.
He had access to the lab and the computers.
He had access to computers earlier than and for hours on end earlier than anybody else basically in the country. And it's also because of his ingenuity and his hard work and his obsession, really, but it all coalesces. And there is this. There needs to be this realization that it requires. You know, the moment you separate out the individual, that individual really is just going to wither because there is so much else that's required. You can't sort of serve as your own shekel. You need to be the half that connects to all the others.
Well, we're getting a little figurative here, but I would say not just that when you separate, if you in reality separate the individual, they wither. But if in your telling of it, you separate out the individual, then I would say you've turned them into an idol.
But what do you mean in your telling of it?
Meaning if you think, oh, the architect is the one who built the thing, or Bill Gates is the person who, he is Microsoft. Forget all the developer. Forget all the things that made him. Forget all the people, you know, Paul Allen and all the other people who made Microsoft happen. You know, then what you've, that's a form of idolatry. And like
and
I
that,
said,
that becomes a problem.
It becomes a problem, but it also becomes a segue into the next part of the parsha.
And I think it's also an interesting point. Yeah, I would think that, you know, usually it serves as a very empowering kind of idea. That even little itty bitty me, I'm just a little teeny tiny half shekel, but I connect to all the other ones, and therefore I actually mean something. Meaning, even though I'm not a Bezalel, I'm not an Aholiyav, and I'm not an Aaron, and I'm not a Moshe, and I'm not a Miriam, and I'm not a Yocheved, you know, I can still connect to everything else that's going on, even by being, you know, what others might call a role player. But we need role players, and you have to have the bricklayers, and you have to have the people who are actually firing the cauldrons to actually melt the gold and all of that. So I think that's usually how we look at this Machatzit HaShekel sort of model, the paradigm, that it gives every sort of I don't know, Tom, Dick, and Harry in Klal Yisrael to sort of connect to everybody else.
Everyone counts, literally.
Yeah, I think how you're viewing it is interesting, which is that it's also sort of something of a cautionary tale, meaning remember that even those great figures require everybody else, that as much as we might revere a Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe is still a human being. He's still part of the Klal, and if the collective sort of fails or fails to recognize its place in servicing him and giving him meaning, then you're in danger of perhaps turning him into an idol.
I mean, it's wild, and again, and I guess it's what's on my mind. But like it, I feel like this issue plays so fundamentally in so many of the political debates, and it's not even debates. I mean, because we're living in such a fractious, polarized time that there's been so much. You know, it really goes both ways. This idea of like demonizing the rich. I mean, we just saw the Amazon deal in New York fall apart last week. And on the flip side, you know, everyone's aggrieved. Oh, they are entitled people who are, you know, think the government should bail them out or take care of them or whatever. Like, it's just the lesson of the Machatzit HaShekel, the idea that we are interdependent, the recognition that people need to be interdependent, and maybe I would think, on the one hand, that's a message which has special significance for the Jewish people, that we recognize we are connected by bonds of family, by bonds of belief, by bonds of shared destiny. But at the same time, I would think that we would, speaking in the United States, as Americans, as citizens, that's a mindset that you would hope. Our countrymen, our leadership, our fellow citizens, our neighbors, we should all find ways to, you know, it's important. It's a way of thinking, which I, you know, as we're getting into this conversation, I'm realizing it's a mindset that seems to be lacking in our world.
Yeah, you don't see it as much. I mean, it tends to be, I think, that, you know, obviously I didn't live through that time, but you get a sense that sort of this is how people were walking around, how people felt, and really during wartime, especially during World War II, there's this idea that, you know, every little bit that you save, every little bit extra that you don't have to buy, that you're able to sort of leave for another person, you're able to sort of impose your own rations upon yourself. Planting a victory garden in your backyard means that you become part of the war effort. It's something that's lacking, and I think that you know, it might just be because we tend to abide by that sort of mentality when we're in crisis mode, and when we're scared and when we're frightened, that's when we all sort of bind together, and maybe things have just been so good that we haven't had to have that kind of mentality.
Well, you know, I don't want us to get too far afield. This is not an American history or a politics podcast, but I
isn't it though?
I guess I'm making everything about politics today. But I think that there's the piece of it is that there's so many sort of strands to grab on there. On paper, at least, we've been in a war since 2001. People have pointed to that lack of solidarity, to the fact that there's no draft anymore. There was no mandatory conscription for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That when you say things were so good, it, you know, because of a lot of the polarization in society, that certainly good and challenge have not been evenly distributed in a way. And I think it's, you know, bringing it back to the Parsha, the fact that it gets back to the very first thing we said, which is that the context for the census is actually a military census.
Right.
So it's very much tied up to the fact that there is going to be shared sacrifice, that everybody, not just that everybody counts, because the truth is that for the purpose of the census, as discussed in the Parsha, not everybody counts. It's only men. It's only not too young, not too old. It's military aged men that have this message. I think the message has greater, you know, the message of it has greater reach. But in reality, I think that the point you made, that it, looking at our recent national history, when solidarity took place and it's tied to military solidarity, it plays out right there in the Parsha. So it's we went further on Machzit HaShekel, the half shekel, than I thought we would, but We definitely should move
on. Next year, when we'll actually talk about the golden calf.
Right, we got to get to the golden calf. So all right. So let's just place this. I wanted to talk about chronology, because there is a stream in rabbinic thought that everything that just happened, which is framed as being Moshe on Mount Sinai, does anyone say that essentially the commandment to have a tabernacle, to have the Mishkan, to have the resting place for God, comes after. But I want to just confirm, because
yeah, that's Rashi.
No, but is it even the commandment is coming afterwards?
Yes, right. Meaning to say that, just to you know, zoom out even a little bit further, beyond just a synopsis of this particular parsha, but sort of looking at this parsha as being a sort of the fulcrum on which the previous two and the next two parshiot stand. Truman Tetzaveh deal with the actual commandments to effectively build the tabernacle. And it means the actual furnishings, the actual edifice, and also the clothing that's going to be worn by the administrators of the Mishkan, the Kohanim. Vayakal and Pekudei basically takes note of the fact, which are the final two parshiot of Sefer Shemot, effectively take note of the fact that everything was done, that the Jewish people followed suit on everything that they were commanded to do. In the middle comes Parshat Ki Tissa, and in the midst of Parshat Ki Tissa comes the sin of the golden calf. So what happened? It sort of sounds like the commands were issued, and then the sin of the golden calf takes place, and then the people sort of double back, and they make good on the promise or on the commandments of that they were given really before the golden calf ever took place, which was to build the Mishkan, and that's certainly one stream in rabbinic thought. The other stream is that it's actually out of order, and that the sin of the golden calf comes first before the people are ever told to, or there's ever a suggestion of creating a tabernacle and all, and that it sounds like it's almost reactionary. That it's not until the sin of the golden calf takes place that we are told to create such a thing as a Mishkan, as a, you know, beautiful wood and gold building, which makes a lot of good sense, meaning a people who show themselves to be not especially adept at maybe, let's say, monotheism in its absolutely purest sense, the idea of having no tangible item to hold on to see, to view, to interact with in a physical and tactile kind of way. And that people that needs to create the calf as a means to sort of attach themselves or feel like they're more connected to something spiritual, that's the people that needs to be given a healthy, appropriate, monotheistic version of that same outlet.
So that's sort of the idea of Hikdim Rifuan Lamaka, this idea that the, or that that's why the chronology is out of order.
Perhaps, maybe that's why the chronology is out of order.
That's the idea in Hebrew and in sort of Jewish thought, that God frequently gives the cure before the disease, that the cure is out there in the world. And so that would be an explanation for why the command for building this tabernacle, for creating an appropriate, like you say, a sort of an appropriate and healthy outlet for the desire, which is expressed in the golden calf, is given as a commandment in the Torah sooner. So taking that approach, Moshe is up there for 40 days. And presumably what he's learning the Torah. God is teaching him all of the Torah, perhaps minus the building, like, you know, minus maybe all of the book of Leviticus, because there's no tabernacle, or maybe the laws of sacrifice look radically different. We have an idea philosophically that the Torah is immutable. It doesn't change. The Torah exists before God even creates the world. But that's I believe that's an idea which is not taken literally in terms of what the words say, but rather that there's a mystical reality to the Torah, which is manifest to us, to our eyes, to our understanding, depending upon what our needs are. So Moshe is up there learning a version of the Torah which doesn't include a tabernacle, and that's, I'm going, you know, this is wildly speculative, of course, and then this something happens. And let's talk about it, because it's shocking to us, and I mean, it's shocking to me, the idea that we read about indisputably the greatest miracle in the history of the world, or the greatest mystical, that God, who is normally outside the realm of nature, outside of our sensory perception, makes himself audible and perceptible to this nation of you know, ex-slaves who are on their way to the Holy Land. That's just like that. I mean, we spoke about it in this way, that's like it's a moment. It's like a moment of in the moral and spiritual development of humanity. I don't say that just in terms of the context of the story of the Torah. That's in the context and story of the Jewish view of life and history. So that happens. And then 40 days later, they're worshiping, they're having this wild bacchanalia, this wild bacchanalia around at the foot of a golden idol. It boggles the mind. So it starts out with them saying that Moshe is running late, which is not, Rashi explains, as kind of a mix up, right?
Yeah, he wasn't actually, but there was this discrepancy over the, you know, over the time or over the timing, which is just so, it's so remarkable, you know, that this is the way that everything unfolds, and that this is the, you know, this is the test that they're, you know, that they're pitted with. What starts off as something as insignificant as just the sense that, you know, somebody's running late, let's just delay, what's going on, there's some confusion over the exact hour and when is he supposed to come, and did the first day really count, or did it not really count, was it part of the 40, wasn't part of the 40, it's so innocent almost, and you just get a sense of how quickly, especially, you know, amongst the masses, how quickly things can just spiral out of control. I mean, we have the good fortune of seeing this all the time today with Facebook, that somebody posts something and just, and it's like an innocent whatever question, comment, assertion, whatever it is about something going on in their life. And the next thing you know, it becomes this whole conversation and an intense one and almost a, you know, can very quickly become a very critical one or a judgmental one about why would you do that and how do you do that? You know, this, that, and the other thing. And everybody starts, you know, weighing in. And you can imagine how sort of in real time when you have this mass of millions of people all gathered in the exact same location, how very quickly this whole thing is able to spin out of control. So what starts is just a very simple error, because it's not kept in check and because there aren't cooler heads about, very quickly just becomes, well, if he's not here, then what are we going to do? If we don't have Moshe, then we don't know how we're going to be able to perform, how we're going to be able to operate, how are we going to connect to God anymore, who's going to serve as the middleman, who's going to serve as the conduit. One thing leads to the next, and somebody has a brilliant idea. Well, why don't we build an effigy?
So I want to unpack that a little bit because, like, firstly, like there's so many things. Like this story, this to me is one, like it's great in its mystery, and by mystery, what I mean is, like, if you found out that there was some betrayal in your family tree, you know, somebody had abandoned the family, or somebody had, yeah, I mean, just something terrible that happened, and that it would sort of be like, you know, you would be working it out in therapy. You'd be like, what went wrong? Where was this? Like, that's sort of how it obviously, in a less personal way. I'm not trying to fully equate anyone who's trying to work through their own family issues, but in my mind, that's sort of how this reads to me, that we read this in the Torah and it becomes like, so firstly is this issue of the lateness. That confusion was, he says, I'm going to be back in 40 days, and they count the day that he left, and he meant 40 full days, meaning starting tomorrow. So we're talking about the difference of a day, and wouldn't you think, wait a little while, send out a search party, so there, which suggests, and they don't do that, which suggests that there's the desire for the idolatry, the desire for this golden calf, is just beneath the surface, right? They're not. It doesn't take a lot to push them, and so that's number one. And then there's kind of like, that's not all, because Rashi, quoting the Talmud, brings Satan into it. The idea, right? He says that on the 16th day, right? The 17th day is the day that Moshe says he's going to be back. Rashi quotes, on the 16th, Satan came and confused the world and displayed an image of darkness, gloom, and confusion to imply Moses must certainly have died. That is why confusion has come to the world. He said to them, Moses has died, for 6 hours have passed and he has not come. As it says in Tractate Shabbos. So that's like, it's like implies like a mass hallucination. Like, it's just the story is wild. But and then it goes not just an idol, but like it breaks up into language that suggests a complete breakdown of the moral order. Right? There's murder. Right, I mean, it says that there are three cardinal sins in Judaism, right? Idolatry, murder, and sexual immorality, and all three take place here in one form or another. The idolatry is on the face of it. The murder, we're told, is actually of Hor, who is the son of Miriam, Moshe's nephew, and actually the grandfather of Bezalel. So you got to think about him building the Mishkan in that context, but it's not explicit, but the Medrash tells us that he is murdered in trying to stop the people from committing this idolatry. And then it says that they got up in the morning to litzachek, to go out and laugh. And that's a word which in the Torah has a promiscuous connotation, let's say. So all three cardinal, so they go from the heights of sanctity and revelation to literally the depths. So it's shocking. I guess that's what I want to say. It's a totally, totally shocking thing. So how do you, what approaches do you take when you think about the sin of the golden calf?
I, It is shocking. It's absolutely shocking. I think that it's shocking, and it's also very telling that you know, nothing, that no degree of sin, of crime, is completely off the table, and it's a function of scenario, of context, and I guess never, you know, really never trusting yourself, as the Mishnah says, that that, like you said, that these things lay immediately beneath the surface. What I think is remarkable about this is that this is all, you know, justified in the name of righteousness. I think that people are panicking. People are panicking that there's this sense that, as you mentioned before, right? It's almost, I think that the reason why it reads so oddly to us is because I don't understand. You're at Sinai. You just witnessed God Himself. Why would you stoop to this level? Why would you go about creating an idol? I think the two answer each other, meaning you just witnessed God and now Moshe's gone. And that's not something that I'm willing to give up. Meaning, if I was still, you know, a slave in Egypt, and I was going about my daily grind as a Jew, then okay, if our leader perishes, then I don't know, we'll find another leader or whatever it is. I think the idea that Moshe was the one who ushered them towards this point of revelation, of the giving of the Torah, of having that very palpable connection with God, and now Moshe is gone, people are just absolutely panicking. And in their panic and in their distress, they come up with the, you know, quickest solution that they possibly can. I think they also, you know, doubt themselves to no small degree. The idea that now with Moshe gone, that we'll be able to connect on our own to God is something that they just don't really perceive of as being a valid option. They need some sort of intermediary, and that's the role that idols classically served, certainly in the ancient world. This is going to be the intermediary between ourselves and God. But the idea that it all just completely spirals out of control from there, and that, you know, in the name of doing what is right and what's just, so then, you know, murder can be justified, and maybe promiscuity can be justified. It all becomes part of this crazy sort of scene in which one thing very, very quickly and very precipitously leads to the other.
So I don't doubt the principle that we always need to be extremely careful, and that, you know, humanity is cut from crooked timber, that we are not perfect, and we shouldn't ever think that we are above any type of transgression. But is the lesson really taken from them? Because, or is there something specific? Like, you know, I on the one hand, I heard you say that this is a lesson for all of us, and obviously we need to learn what we can learn from whoever, but it seems to me that there's something specific. I think you sort of alluded to this later, that this is because of the experience that they had just had. And I want to frame it in the context of a question that I have, the question of Yeridat HaDorot, this idea in Judaism that each generation removed from Mount Sinai is one generation further removed from that moment of inspiration and that moment of closeness with God, and therefore, just by virtue of being born later than somebody who was born, you know, than our great-grandparents or our great-great-grandparents, that on some spiritual level, we are lower than them. And yet, it seems to me, and that's a principle that's pretty widespread in Judaism, and yet it seems to me that when you look at the specifics of who these people are and what they went through, they're not a very sophisticated it doesn't seem very sophisticated, the idea that they are, they seem like people who, you know, and I'm not to disparage, but they're operating on this slave mentality. They've put too much faith in a human being. They have perhaps conflated or confused Moshe with God. I mean, there's language here where they say, we need to replace Moshe because Moshe's dead. Let's build an idol for us to worship. So there's a lot of confusion. I guess I'm not saying that we are not capable of the confusions of our own context and our own mistakes, but it seems like there it's, I guess, how maybe I'm wrong to to put it in the terms of their spiritual level, and they are on a great spiritual level. But I guess my point is that it looks like the mistake they're making is very much based in their situation, their place in their time, and where they're coming from. That this is that it's like, and maybe this would be the case with anybody, that it's a nation in its infancy. They're like babies, essentially. They're like babies whose bottle has gone missing, or whose mother is, you know, like they're missing something, and they're very much operating, and similarly, like, you know, the idolatry of Egypt, the things that they knew before, like, are just all of a sudden that like they ignore the Ten Commandments, they ignore the prohibition of idolatry, and now they're just popping right back into Egypt mode.
Yeah, I think so a number of things, really.
Yeah, that was a lot. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I like the example of, you know, the baby who's lost his bottle, in the sense that there's something really visceral about that, right? The baby knows nothing else and wants that with such passion that the baby is going to just go absolutely bonkers, you know, once it's removed. And as far as the Yiridat HaDorot question, the idea that if it's really true that the further you go back generation by generation to Sinai, you're taking a look at a people that was on a higher spiritual level and that much closer to God, then how do you explain everything that's going on here? Yeah, I wonder, do we crave spirituality? Do we pine for a relationship with God today the way that they did then? They did something absurd in order to try to preserve the relationship that they had felt, even but for a few moments, when Moshe was up on the mountain and God was speaking to them, and they would do absolutely anything to hold on to that. And I wonder if we're really in the same place. I wonder if we have that same sort of gut reaction that when somehow, you know, yesterday I was feeling really spiritual and today I'm not. So what am I going to do? I'll binge watch on Netflix. Like, that's my reaction. Like, yesterday I was feeling, yesterday was Yom Kippur, I was feeling so connected and so great and so passionate and so wonderful and so connected to God, and now today I don't, so what am I going to do? Nothing. And I wonder if we, if that's exactly what we're witnessing. We're witnessing a people that became so enamored with the idea of closeness to God that they're even willing to do something that is just absolutely shocking and absolutely startling. But as much as, you know, the piece about idolatry, I think, is almost, it's that it's theologically a little bit more complicated, in the sense that we've always had a conduit. We've always had a middleman. That middleman is gone. That middleman needs to be replaced. Would we replace God? Chas v'shalom, we never would. God forbid, we would never do such a thing. But Moshe is gone, and we need to replace Moshe. You allowed us to have Moshe. I presume that we're allowed to have something that serves as this kind of a go-between. How that then becomes license for murder thereafter? Well, because anybody who's going to stand in the way of our ability to reconnect with God must be a villain himself, and he'll be killed. How that then allows for promiscuity, meaning it's one step after the other and after the other and after the other, and the sorts of things that aren't that don't even seem to be really connected to the actual need that they're expressing from the outset, somehow or another become wrapped up in this entire process. And I guess that's what I mean. The idea that even those acts and those items that never would have been within the realm of possibility had you asked any of these people just a day before, somehow or another become part of what they're capable of once they set down a particular path.
So I have to tell you, I really love that explanation. I think it, like, the fact that there's a desperate desire to connect to God and the spiritual that I think it's fair to say our generation does not have nearly the same way. I love that. I think that's true, and I think it plays into this image of it's a young nation, and so, you know, you could, I think philosophers have had this, you know, is what's you know, and better is a tough word, but like is a full grown adult or an old man, you know, better than a young child? The old man has the experience, but he's, you know, also gone through the ringer a couple of times, and the baby is a blank slate, but it's got so much potential, and you know, its desires are so clear cut. They may be very, very basic, but at the same time they're very, very pure. And that's a great way to think about it. So I think that clarifies things.
I think that we can. Yeah, I think that this is, you know, the constant tug of war, that as we become more adept and more capable, and we have more life experience, and we become, frankly, more sophisticated, we almost can become prisoners of our own sophistication. And that gut reaction, that visceral sort of longing, and the visceral almost belief, right? What do we say? And I wouldn't suggest that this is a bad thing, but what do we do as soon as we hear, you know, a story about, oh, one of the, you know, great rabbinic sages of old, and he did, you know, so-and-so? We say, wait a second. Did he really do that? Did he actually? Is that? And I don't think there's anything, you know, wrong with that degree of question and inquiry any more than we try to pull apart and tear apart every single, you know, line of the Talmud and every single verse of the Torah, and we try to explore it and really wonder. And it's true that children are going to more readily just accept anything that's told them, because they don't have the life experience to really compare it to and question whether or not it's accurate. But there's a real challenge there. There's a real challenge there in that with inquiry and explanation comes an ability to sort of detach from that need, that longing, that sense that I need, you know, God to protect me, and he's here, and I'm sort of in his embrace, because it's almost like I can take care of myself. And even our relationship with Torah starts to change a little bit as we get older, in most ways for the good, but we have to keep it in check.
So talking about the consequences of the golden calf, Moshe is carrying down the tablets, and there's this phenomenal image that, firstly, there's this, you know, the sort of the parallel of like of word versus image, right? The figure of the calf, which is, I don't think it's any great significance other than just that, like, calves, livestock were worshipped. Maybe there's more to it than that, but on a basic level, it's kind of the thing. It's kind of the thing that happened in the ancient Near Eastern world, versus the solid words that are engraved. So it's like a word versus image, and the image comes of the words sort of fly off of the tablets, and the words, and this is just such a great thing to think about. The words have a lightness to them. The words sort of make it so that the Moshe can hold the tablets, and as soon as the words depart, he, right, and you know, you read the Torah, it seems, you know, not clear. Maybe he throws them down, but this image is that he can't hold them anymore. He can't support them anymore. It's kind of like it's sort of like the like the Sorcerer's Apprentice in Fantasia, right, where Mickey Mouse makes the broom to do his work, and it gets out of control, and they're pouring water, and he's all of a sudden about to drown. Like, it's like, and then the wizard comes back and's like, oh, you took my magic hat, and what'd you do? And it's like that. Like, Moshe gets down to the bottom of the mountain and goes, oh my, like, what happened here? How did things deteriorate so quickly? How did this happen? And like the people, it's like, you know, you imagine they kind of like blink a couple of times and go like, oh my goodness, what, like, how did we get in this mess? So the tablets are broken, the faith is broken with the people, and the rest of the parsha, or a big part of it, is about the reconstruction, how to get back there.
I think that I love the sort of that that parallel, right? That sort of Moshe's coming with the luchot, and that the people are there with the image. That's really the whole. That's really the whole of this problem, right? That really stands at the crux of this entire issue. That what Judaism really states is that there are no physical images. It's just it's words. It's ideas. It's communication. It's information. What Hashem gives us to connect to Him with is a sense of how He views the world, which we call the Torah, which He calls the Torah, which we call the Torah. Sort of the divine impression of reality. It's just divine wisdom, divine thoughts, and that is a very difficult thing to connect to. And sort of Moshe comes with his presentation of what Judaism is supposed to be about, and the people have sort of already conjured up their image of what they're really much more comfortable with. I think it's also interesting, and I wonder, you know, the idea of this calf, how interesting it is that the calf is a baby, and that maybe it represents sort of the people viewing themselves in that same sort of position of desperation, that they're looking for the sustenance of their of the mother figure of Hashem to be able to provide to them. And they feel like they're just all alone if they don't have that. Hence, we, you know, we build this image in order to be able to connect to you. But it's ultimately it's the words that conquer, and it's the words that really create the contours of what Judaism actually is.
So I'm just kind of like leafing through the rest of it, and there's so much to talk about. I don't know if our listeners are gonna stick around if we go through the entirety of the things that happen. I think it's important to kind of state that. So much of the aftermath is about, can God return to the camp? Is reconciliation possible? And I think a big way to read that, the main way to read that, is that it then, whether or not it happens chronologically in order or out of order, that building the Mishkan, building the tabernacle, becomes a part of the reconciliation process. And oh God, there's so many fascinating things I'd love to touch on here, but I do think we should, you know, there really is always more to talk about, and we'll have it, I guess, for next year, talking about, I mean, Moshe, his face shines and he's in the cleft of the rock. I mean, there's so many. Read the Parsha. Let this spur you on, because this one is so chock full of amazing and fascinating things, and things that set the stage for our understanding of Judaism and the Torah.
You might say that there's always more to learn.
I think I'm about to. The Portion Podcast is recorded in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, produced by Aaron Roller. Our theme music is The Maggid's Niggun by Simply Tzfat. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends about it any way you can. We are sponsored by the Pravda Family Foundation. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate us and leave a review. Follow us on Facebook. Have a good Shabbos. And remember, there is always more to learn.